Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today on the program, we remember Captain Al Haynes, the pilot that helped save 184 passengers on United Flight 232 that crash-landed in Siouxland 30 years ago this summer. But first, we hear about the latest efforts to prevent the Trans-Canada XL pipeline from running through Nebraska. Nebraska's highest court lifted one of the last major hurdles for the XL pipeline last Friday when it rejected another attempt to derail the project. Opponents wanted to force the developer to reapply for state approval. The court upheld the decision of state regulators who voted in November of 2017 to greenlight a route through the state. The decision was a victory for the $8 billion project. It's been mired in lawsuits and regulatory hearings since it was proposed in 2008. Art Tandarup is a farmer from Neely, Nebraska. He's opposed to the pipeline. Tandarup says three routes have been suggested for the pipeline, and he believes all three of them are potentially dangerous for Nebraskans who live above the High Plains Aquifer. It provides water to more than 80% of the people who live on the High Plains.
We're in what's called the Eastern Sandhills here, and we're also still over the aquifer, and the aquifer is very high here in places. So the same issues that applied on, quote, the Sandhills route apply here. And I noticed even in the ruling today, you know, they said, well, the route was, this mainline alternative route takes it all out of the sand hills and off the aquifer, which is a blatant lie. We aren't in favor of any of these three routes. There's no good route across Nebraska.
Tandarup donated part of his land that was destined for the pipeline to the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska to allow them to plant sacred corn. That designation would, in theory, have protected the land from being used by the pipeline.
That land, the route is there. I mean, you know, it comes through that sacred corn, and that ground belongs to the Ponca now. And so if TC Energy decides to, you know, move ahead with eminent domain, which today's ruling gives them the right to do, and, you know, unless we do some kind of an appeal or something, then they will probably have a legal challenge on that from the Ponca Nation. And I can't speak for the Ponca Nation, but I believe there would be a challenge there.
Tandarup says there are also three federal lawsuits pending against the pipeline, which may delay any construction.
As landowners, you know, we'll probably have to decide, you know, if we want to pursue anything else, you know, and I have no idea what that might be, but there might be something that we could legally pursue in Nebraska. But right now, I guess we're looking at the federal lawsuits, at the three federal lawsuits, as, you know, it's definitely going to take some time to work through those lawsuits. And, you know, we'll have to see what happens there.
TC Energy issued a statement last Friday saying that the Supreme Court decision was another important step as, quote, we advance towards building this vital energy infrastructure project. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, there's another vital energy infrastructure project that's been going on in Nebraska and Iowa for some years. Corn-based ethanol has become an energy source that has grown into a huge industry. President Donald Trump, however, may be shaking the faith of some farm-based supporters with his administration's action to cut demand for that fuel. Earlier this month, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency let 31 oil refineries off the hook from a requirement to blend 1.4 billion gallons of ethanol and biodiesel into their fuel. Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley derided the number of waivers and their effect on Iowa corn farmers and the ethanol industry.
Seems to me the bottom line is that EPA is undermining congressional intent in the RFS, and it's surely hurting farmers in Iowa and rural America.
The Trump administration has granted 85 refineries a pass from buying 4 billion gallons of renewable fuel, and that has killed demand for 1.4 billion bushels of corn used to make it. Industry groups say those exemptions are driving 15 ethanol plants to close nationwide. One of them is in Merrill, Iowa. Mati Shah is the executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association.
Quite frankly, people out here are pretty upset, and they have a right to be. The president campaigned on protecting the RFS and defending the RFS, and then to have the EPA in a very in a manner that was completely unjustified based on the law and the current market conditions to undermine that. You know, I said it the day they came out. I said, this breaks his promise. I don't like saying that. I would have rather said nice, wonderful things about him keeping his promise. Not because I'm pro-Trump or anti-Trump, but because that would have been, A, the right decision, and B, it would have been good for our rural communities.
That was Monty Shaw, the executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. While many farmers are concerned about the status of renewable fuels like ethanol and the effect of ongoing tariffs, in Iowa, farmland values are holding up fairly well. While Midwest farmland values fell 1% from a year ago during the second quarter of 2019, Iowa's farmland values actually went up 1%, according to an update Friday from the Chicago Federal Reserve. Iowa Farm Bureau Director of Ag Analytics and Research, Sam Funk, says he wasn't too surprised by the report. Funk says most land values are determined at the local level and are tied to income and land availability.
You've got different aspects with what the Chicago Fed had put out, and one of them is this quarterly aspect looking at changes in good farmland. And changes in good farmland for Iowa actually, last year they took a little bit of a downturn, and then they came back up in the quarter since. So, you know, and there again, there's also a lag in some of these take place. So when you think about what's going on, typically right now we still have a very strong productive base in Iowa agriculture. Despite all the challenges that are out there, that good ag ground for cropland is still relatively valuable, which makes a strong balance sheet position for farmers still going forward, even though financial times are challenging.
I read that Iowa's doing a little bit better than other Midwest states. Is that right?
You know, you think about the hardships that we had with some of the flooding earlier, you know, whether it be on the western side of Iowa when we saw the Missouri River basically flood twice, and then we saw some flooding around the Mississippi River side and flooding throughout the state, and it was so wet. But yet at the same time, while Iowa was very wet and we delayed planting a lot, we got a lot more of our crop planted earlier than did some of our neighboring states, specifically Iowa, Indiana, out through there, Illinois and Indiana as we go back toward the east. And if you think about then the condition of the crop in the state of Iowa, it tends to be actually looking a little better than some of other states which were later planted yet. Not to say that everything is just grand and rosy throughout the state, but USDA still has in their reports, a very strong outlook compared to the weather conditions that we've seen so far this year. So it's really a waiting game to see just what these yields are going to be this year.
Well, yeah, and you have the yields, and also people are concerned about the whole tariff situation and commodity prices. What is your take on those issues?
You know, when you think about the market challenges, obviously there have been years when prices haven't been as strong as what we had experienced not so long ago. Obviously, Iowa farmers really hope that we can get a resolution for a lot of these trade issues. And part of that is really to move forward with what we know is available to us right now and we're just waiting on, such as approval of the USMCA. So if you think about some of those strong points for parts of Iowa agriculture, like hog production. So Iowa leads the United States in hog production. We think about our number one volume market for pork in exports is Mexico. So So obviously it's critically important for us to do what we can right now, and USMCA is one of those great aspects to focus on right now for what can we do to really improve the future conditions and trade ability for Iowa producers, and USMCA comes to the top.
That's interesting you say that, because mostly I hear people talking about the situation with China, but the USMCA is definitely something that actually lawmakers have control over, and they can pass that when they want to.
Oh, absolutely. And while China is very important to us because it is the number one, it has been the number one soybean importer in the world, when we think about exports, obviously, soybeans from Iowa have been a very strong export market. But we've got to think about this as well. They're facing critical shortfalls for their swine herd with ASF in China, and there's a lot of other challenges right now that are going through there. What we know that we can focus in on and what's an attainable goal for us is passage of the USMCA. And as you talked about right now, it's really one of those where the administration has brought that program to the table. It's something that a lot of people on all sides of the political spectrum have agreed on, that it is critical for us to have sound trade with both Mexico and Canada as well from the United States. And it's ready and waiting for us to be able to make sure that those markets remain viable for us, because Mexico and Canada are two of our strongest and obviously closest neighbors.
The African swine fever, is that what you were talking about?
African swine fever, ASF, which has gained, if you will, a foothold in a number of Asian countries, including in China. So there have been estimates for up to, you know, more than a third, and maybe even up closer to a half of the sow herd has taken ill and been destroyed because of ASF. And as you look at China having the largest swine herd in the world, for them to lose half of that swine herd is just absolutely dramatic.
That was the Iowa Farm Bureau's Director of Ag Analytics and Research, Dr. Sam Funk, talking about the relative strength of Iowa's farmland values. Those values increased by 1% over the last quarter, compared to a slight drop in farmland values overall in Midwestern states. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. While there has been a lot of concern over land values, tariffs, and commodity prices, Iowa has opened up to a new crop that might help diversify the state's ag economy. The 2018 Farm Bill opened the door for commercial hemp production in the U.S. by legalizing it as an agricultural commodity and removing it from the list of federally controlled substances. It also gave states and the federal government shared regulatory authority over hemp production. Earlier this year, a hemp bill passed through the Iowa Senate and the Iowa House of Representatives, and Governor Reynolds signed it into law. The Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship is developing a state plan to license and regulate production of hemp and submit it to the USDA for approval. Robin Prusner is the state entomologist and ag security coordinator at the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Prusner says three things need to happen before it's legal to grow hemp in Iowa.
The first is that USDA actually needs to release their federal rules that would implement the 2018 Farm Bill. And the USDA is fast-tracking this. Usually rules take a considerable amount of time. They just started it this spring. They say they're going to be done this fall. Once those rules are out, then the second thing happens, and that is that the Department of Agriculture here in Iowa needs to send in a state plan, as it's so-called, to the USDA, and the USDA has 60 days to approve or deny it. And then finally, once we get that approval, we have to put notice in the Iowa Administrative Bulletin. It's a law bulletin here in the state of Iowa that is published every 2 weeks.
Also, it seems like farmers need to take a look at whether growing hemp would be good for them, what they need to grow hemp. I'm assuming it's a little different than, you know, corn or soybeans.
It is, and I think that people make some assumptions that it's just a different seed that they put in the ground. First, they need to determine what it is they want to grow. You don't just grow hemp. You decide if you're growing for fiber, for grain, for seed, or for cannabidiol, called CBD for short. And you're going to choose different varieties, and you may have different, wildly different practices, depending on which one of those crops it is that you wish to produce.
So you might choose to do, say, one or the other.
Yes. And I have a list of what I call unsolicited advice. And my number one piece of advice for producers in Iowa is that you don't plant hemp unless you have a contract to sell it first. This isn't like growing corn, where you can sell it to one co-op or a different co-op or an ethanol plant. You need to have your buyer lined up. They may have specifications about how they want you to grow it. And you need to have that contract in place. It's not an open market where you grow it and then you try and find a buyer. We are not, that market is not that developed yet.
Mostly I've heard, well, you just decide if you're going to do, if you're going to do fiber or you're going to do oil.
Yes. The infrastructure for this industry is in its infancy. So we don't have a fiber plant, you know, every 100 miles. I'm only aware of two fiber plants operating, one in Kentucky, one in North Carolina. So your transportation costs are immense to go down there. From a grain perspective, no hemp product is legal to feed to livestock or animals at this point in time. So again, what is your market?
Do you see hemp eventually becoming helpful for farmers to grow, like an alternative crop kind of thing? Or I've seen people say, well, it's better if you start out with a small amount of it, like 40 acres or less.
The inputs, the seed and the clones, are costly. So you want to watch that. I often suggest to people that they connect with growers in other states or companies in other states that can provide them that information on what to do and when to do and how to do it. Another thing to keep in mind is that in Iowa right now, there are no legal pesticides for hemp. So you cannot even spray like a burn down in that field in the spring. That would not be legal. We definitely know that there are insect pests that can be a problem for hemp. I just heard from a grower in Illinois this morning that they have the Eurasian hemp borer in their field. I've also heard of other hemp borers. European corn borer, a common pest here in the Midwest, can also attack hemp. So the producer really needs to consider how they're going to go about managing this crop and what it is that they can actually do to deal with those issues.
It does sound like there's really a lot you have to know about this to do it right.
I really promote to people that they really need to be educated, not just through the University of Google, but talk to those experienced growers in other parts of the country. I really do promote the idea of doing a lot of research, starting small. And in fact, in Iowa, you cannot have more than 40 acres. So Iowa is, the state law is actually limiting that right there. So people don't bet the farm, so to speak, and come out on the wrong end of that.
That was Robin Prusner, state entomologist and ag security coordinator at the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. She says farmers can't legally grow hemp in Iowa until the USDA approves the state's proposed regulatory plan. Hemp production will likely not be fully legalized until the 2020 growing season at the earliest. Well, Prusner recommends that those who want to farm hemp or work with hemp do more than just check with Google, and they can do that with a new program at Doane University in Crete, Nebraska. The school is set to launch a professional cannabis certificate program, the first of its kind offered by a university in that state. Courses will be available later this fall. Chemistry professor Dr. Andrea Holmes is heading up the program. Holmes says the important thing to remember when looking at hemp, it's a lot different than growing, say, medical marijuana.
And you cannot jump fences. If you're in the marijuana, if you have licensing in the marijuana space, then you cannot really do any business with the hemp space, vice versa. So there's quite a difference. And between marijuana and hemp, even though they both originate from cannabis.
Well, yeah, and you're a chemist, so you can really explain to people who are worried about hemp being a drug. It's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so hemp is declassified. It's a non-controlled substance as long as the content of THC, which is a psychotropic component of cannabis, if that is below 0.3%, then it's considered hemp, and hemp is declassified and not controlled anymore by the Drug Enforcement Agency. So now, when it's declassified and not a controlled substance anymore, you can transport across state lines without the truckers being thrown in jail. You can possess hemp-derived products without being scared that you'll get prosecuted by the feds. And, you know, or having the products be seized, and we can now operate legally with hemp-derived products.
I was reading there's a wide variety of jobs in when you talk about the hemp industry, from, you know, being a chemist, working on that side, or helping to put together the different products, to growing, to managing farms. I was really surprised.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In Denver, while I was on sabbatical leave, one of my absolute amazing adventures was to build a hemp extraction company. And basically, from that perspective, I can already tell you the jobs in processing facilities are tremendous. I mean, processors need anybody from quality control, biomass treatment, extraction techs, processing techs, refinement people, R&D chemists, plant medicinal scientists, engineers, analytical chemists who are doing all of the testing, then all of the ancillary positions that come along with it, whether it's administration, marketing, sales, finance, all the C-level positions. And then there's even further ancillary positions like payroll companies that are serving the cannabis industry, banking that are serving the cannabis industry, insurance. I mean, it's an endless list. And if you think about it, it's just like any other industry, whether you're in petroleum, in pharma, or in cannabis. The jobs are just as multifold in that space.
Yeah, and looking at your program that's going to be starting up in, is it in October that it starts?
We're going to launch it people can sign up for it in the fall. And I think October, November is when they're signing up and registering. And then we're going to launch in November, December.
Tell me a little bit about this certificate. What kind of things will a student be able to learn?
Yes, so it was our intention to build a really rigorous curriculum for students to get the benefit of learning everything from the front end to the end end. So they're going to start learning everything about the seeds, the genetics, how can you cultivate tissue culture, how do you harvest, what type of lighting conditions are needed, how do you then do the post-harvesting techniques like drying and milling, how are things being extracted and processed, then how are they being infused in a consumer-facing product, how are these things tested along the way so that they're staying compliant, what does the legal space look like? How do people practice legally and stay within the law and are compliant? And all the way down to legal implications, global outlooks, financial implications, economics. Basically, we want people to have the ability to get a really, really in-depth view of the industry so that they gain the qualifications to either enter the industry or if they just are interested in the space. I mean, I can tell you, I have so many physicians that don't know anything about it, healthcare professionals that really want to know about this. Maybe they're just interested in the health benefits, and then they can just take the first course where we have medical doctors give lectures on just the wellness benefits. Maybe they're interested really more in the legal aspects, the regulations, and then they can take the third course that is heavily focused on that content. So the certificate, you can either take one course and then you get a course certificate, or you can take the sequence of all three courses and then you get an actual program certificate. And these are credentials that you can then present on your resume to show people that you have these this competency if you are looking for a position.
That was chemistry professor Dr. Andrea Holmes. She's heading up the Professional Cannabis Certificate Program at Doane University in Crete, Nebraska. The program begins in November. Hundreds of people have expressed interest so far. Listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, summer, sadly, is just about over. Labor Day weekend is fast approaching, and here in Siouxland, that means so is Art Splash. Siouxland Public Media summer intern Mae McFarland talked to the Sioux City Art Center's development coordinator about this annual event.
The end of summer in Sioux City is always signified by Art Splash, and now, in its 26th summer, it has become a key piece to Sioux City culture. The woman behind the festival is Erin Weber-Driesen, and she has some exciting information about this year's festival.
We have an influx of new artists this year, which I'm really excited about. We have the opportunity to show them what Sioux City is all about and how welcoming we are to our artists and the community in general, how welcoming we are. That's a signature of what we do. People always say, I love going to this festival. From the artist perspective, they say, I love going to this festival because they treat us like royalty. We have new children's activities. We've got new things to do and new stage entertainment. It's always an exciting time at Art Splash. You've got your familiar favorites, but then you also have just new exciting surprises around every corner.
With over 100 booths consisting of 80 artists and a ton of activities for kids and families to enjoy, there's plenty to do at Art Splash. The most important part of Art Splash isn't necessarily the artists, but the volunteers that help to make the whole event possible. Here's how you can help.
If you go through the Art Center website, at the top, there's a little Art Splash tab. Just click on that, and you can get involved that way. So you kind of, click through, and we'll get you signed up. So there's all kinds of ways to contribute, and you can sign up for a couple of hours. You can sign up for the whole weekend. It really depends on your availability, but we will find something for you to do. You can take care of the artists all weekend, or just for a few hours. Booth sit or bring them snacks. You can help out in the children's activities. Take tickets for the bouncies. Help out at main stage. Help out with the food area. There's all kinds of stuff. And really, it's something that makes you feel good to give back to our community. And the volunteer aspect of this community is what sets us apart. We really give back, and it's something that makes us very special in Siouxland. Okay. This is our seventh year at Riverside Park. Okay. And it's August 31st and September 1st. On Saturday, the festival is open 10 to 6, and on Sunday, it's open 10 to 5. So come out, join us. We have a blast every year. It is something that we look forward to as a staff of the Art Center, and we just knock it out of the park. We absolutely love hosting the citizens of Sioux City out there. So thanks for joining us.
Make sure to head over to Riverside Park over Labor Day weekend to enjoy the festival, support local arts, and the Sioux City Art Center. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Mae McFarlane.
That's Siouxland Public Media's summer intern, Mae McFarlane, who's now back at school in Minnesota, starting her sophomore year. Well, besides all of the artwork, there's also food and entertainment at Art Splash this Saturday and Sunday. One of the artists taking the stage this weekend talked to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer. Here's Angie Lambrecht.
I love the arts and I love music, and to be able to bring it all together in one big festival is amazing.
That's great. And what kind of things can people hear during your set that you're going to do at Art Splash? Do you have like an hour on the stage?
I have a 90-minute set that I'll be performing at 3 o'clock. I'm really excited about it. I'll be bringing my guitar, my suitcase kick, and tambourine. I'm even going to be breaking out my vibraphone set that I have to play a few different ballads on.
So you're a multi-instrumentalist as well as an amazing singer.
Yes.
You have this little
drum. Yeah, I do. It's a Samsonite suitcase that I put up on its side. I threw some legs on the back and a pedal in the front. I can play it, kind of mimics like a kick drum. And then I've got a tambourine that I've also mounted onto a gate pedal. And then I can play those with my feet, so I can play some percussion with my feet when I go ahead and I can play the guitar and blow on a harmonica and kind of fill out a whole sound as a solo artist.
All at the same time.
One-man band, man.
How are you able to do that? I guess you have to have talent. Or is it a lot of practice?
It's a lot of practice. I studied drums for a majority of my life. I did a lot of independent studies on each of my limbs. So it kind of all fell into place once I cracked code and put it into a different rotation, a different instruments in each hand and kind of put it all together. And definitely took a lot of time. And I'm still learning every day, like, you know. I can get better and better, and I just keep going at it. I was busted flat up in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, feeling nearly as faded as my jeans.
You recently helped us out with the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. We did a live broadcast for the Exchange, and you stepped in, and I think you sound better than Janis Joplin, and you said that was a big influence for you.
She is, and that is very kind. That's a very kind compliment. It's an honor to be compared to such a great musician. A dirty red bandana. I'd been playing soft, you know, and Bobby sang the blues, yeah.
You have your own different energy and your own different vibe and different style as well. And you also write your own music.
I do.
Mm-hmm. And what inspires you? I guess, tell me a little bit about one of the favorite songs that you've ever put together.
One of my favorite songs I ever put together. It's a great question. It's more of a recent one. Well, I guess it was last winter. My fiance Sean and I wrote a song called Neptune In, and that's been one of my favorite songs, I think, that I've ever wrote and co-wrote with someone else.
Well, Neptune's son is smiling at me while he takes off his shoes and dips into the sea, and he knows that he's got somewhere else to be.
It kind of ties in the planets and relationships as far as we're all individuals and we're allowed to shine on our own, you know, just by being who we are. And it makes the world a better place by the balance that occurs when everybody kind of does what they're to do.
And without saying a word, you know they each take a turn.
That's great.
Yeah.
And speaking of shining on your own, you're going to be playing by yourself during Art Splash, but you are also the lead singer of another great musical group. It is called Ultraviolet Fever. You're the lead singer of that group as well.
Got me a real nice honey bee. Now you know he treats me good.
And you guys have been going how many years strong?
We've been about 3.5-4 years that Ultraviolet Fever has been around. It'll be 4 years come this fall.
That's kind of an eternity, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It's cool. It's very cool. I feel like we've really sunk into a very comfortable place, and being able to just continue to put out music and what we're doing is working, so we're just going to keep going for it.
And what are some of your favorite songs with that group that you like to do?
Some of my favorite songs with that group. Well, as a full ensemble, I love doing some of our real bluesy, funky tunes. Really gets everyone going, and it's just such a fun to play, like Pocket Full of Mojo.
I got a pocket full of mojo. I got an ace in the hole. Now with the voice of an angel, I could make any man fold.
recently, Sean and I have been doing a lot as a duo, and we've got a tune called Black Clouds that's one of my favorites to play with him. We've really started introducing the harmonica into some of these new songs. So that's what I would say.
And Sean is your fiancé.
He is my fiancé.
You met through doing music together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were playing in two different projects at the time when we had met. We were billed at the same establishment, the Vanguard Arts here in Sioux City. And just kind of, we were really digging what each other were doing and made plans to jam, and it all just kind of worked itself organically from there.
And you're making beautiful music together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For sure. Any big shows coming up beyond Art Splash?
Beyond the Art Splash. We'll be performing up in Vermilion at the Dakota Brick House on the 5th. We're really excited to make our way to Chicago at the end of September and play at one of their legendary music clubs called the Shubas. We'll be playing with another fellow from Sioux City. He's relocated to Chicago, and his band, the Winchesters, is putting out an album in their album release party. They've invited us to come perform on. So we're really excited about that one.
And people can hear you play at Art Splash. Do you usually go to Art Splash?
When I'm in town, I do. I love going to Art Splash. Free festival with art and music. You know, it's a good deal.
Teach me to love each day.
That's the lead singer of Ultraviolet Fever, Angie Lambrecht, talking to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer. She recorded a song during her recent visit to our studios, and you can hear it at the end of today's show. For more information about Art Splash, go to the Art Center's website, siouxcityartcenter.org. Not too long ago in Sioux City, we remembered the 30th anniversary of the crash of Flight 232. And the pilot of United Flight 232, Al Haynes, died this Sunday at the age of 87 after a short illness in Seattle. Captain Haynes was credited with helping to save the lives of 184 passengers and crew members after the plane lost an engine and hydraulics over northwest Iowa. A potentially catastrophic situation was handled with experience and absolute calm. Woodbury County Emergency Services Director Gary Brown worked through the aftermath of the crash landing that brought him into the path of Al Haynes. He spoke to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer about the pilot who felt humbled by his achievements and worked to improve aviation for others.
Listen to the input of other people and their thoughts and ideas, and he would share in the responsibilities. He wasn't the kind of captain that says, I'm in charge, get over it, kind of thing. So he was a very humble man. He was very much a family man. Al had a wife, Darlene, and two children, a boy and a girl. Darlene, his wife, passed away on the evening before the 10th anniversary of the crash. His son was killed in a motorcycle collision. And then his daughter was diagnosed with cancer, and she's, I believe, still in remission. Al loved Little League. He was an umpire and announcer in Little League for decades. But, you know, after the crash of Flight 232, it really became Al's mission to take the lessons learned from the crash of Flight 232 and shared those with other communities and businesses around the world. When I say Al did thousands of speeches, I'm not exaggerating, and I'm guessing he touched over a million people with his presentations over the last 30 years. And his message was, to the communities, be prepared, to businesses, have an emergency plan, work together as a team, strive to be the best you possibly can, because when you're hit with a crisis, you don't have time to think things through. So, that really became Al's mission after the crash for the last 30 years. He quit traveling a few years back because his health just wasn't, and his stamina just wasn't there. He loved his family. He loved this community, called Siouxland his second home. Every time he came back here, he would shake everybody's hand that was standing in line. He'd give autographs. But his message was, thank you for everything you did for my crew and I and the families and the passengers who were on board that aircraft. That was his, he couldn't come back enough. And every time he did, he had that message.
He was last here 5 years ago?
He was here for the 25th anniversary, yeah, 5 years ago in July, this last July. And, you know, we as a community kind of said the 25th anniversary was going to be the last public event associated with the anniversaries of the crash. You know, we still get family members and survivors that stop into the community and visit. We still get company. We still get phone calls from other communities. But the commitment was on that 25th anniversary from the crew and the community was that should be the punctuation mark.
And you developed a very close relationship with him over the years.
Al and I were friends, just like with several of the crew members. We're all friends. The 232 crew calls them, they're the 232 family. And they had a lot of cousins. They had a lot of friends of the family, so to speak, that were a part of it. The crew used to get together every year on the anniversary of the crash. Had not been doing that recently as much, but Al was everybody's friend. I don't think he ever met anybody he didn't like. He'd make friends in a room full of strangers without even trying. It was amazing. I was at several presentations with Al where we would co-present, and as he would stand up to the microphone to begin his presentation, he would get a standing ovation before he ever said a word. And then after his presentation, he would get a standing ovation, and there would literally be a line of people waiting to shake his hand and say hi to him or to get his autograph.
United 232, how is your city?
We have no hydraulic fluid, which means we have no elevator control, almost none, and very little aileron control. I have serious doubts about making the airport. Have you got someplace near there that we might be able to ditch? Unless we get control of this airplane, we're going to put it down wherever it happens to be.
And when you listen to the cockpit recordings of that day, he was just so calm, collected, and even had a sense of humor.
That was Al. That was Al on July 19, 1989, and that was Al throughout the whole time I knew him. He always had that way of helping you to not get excited. He did that with his crew. He did that with the air traffic controllers, the passengers, the flight attendants. If you listen to all the different recordings that were going on, including the internal cockpit communications, the whole crew was calm. Al was calm. The whole crew was calm. They knew they had an emergency. They knew they were in pretty deep trouble. I don't think they knew how bad a trouble they were in, but he was very calm. And he had a lot of humor in him.
United 232 Heavy, the wind's currently 360 at 11. 360 at 11, you're cleared to land on any runway.
You want to be particular and make it a runway, huh?
You said he didn't like to be called a hero, but there was a movie made about the situation, and Charlton Heston played him,
right.
Probably one of the, you know, an actor known for playing heroes.
Folks, this is Captain Haynes. Here's a little update. We're currently cruising at 37,000 feet, just passing over the town of Alta, Iowa, estimating arrival in Chicago right on time.
What did he think about having himself up there on the big screen?
Really get into that a lot. He was very content with being involved with his family in Little League and making his presentations around the country. I think he was honored that an actor the caliber of Charlton Heston played his part. And he came into Sioux City for the premiere of the movie. The premiere was played here. And he came into town for that and was able to meet Charlton Heston and several of the other actors that were involved in the movie. But that was not, Al wasn't in for the spotlight stuff and the glitz and glamour. He had a mission to take care of his family, to be involved with the crew and to spread the message of preparedness.
And that's something that we can all use in our lives.
Absolutely. You know, he was a great man. He was, even though he wasn't big, he was tall in all of our eyes. He was a huge person to all of us. And we're going to miss him. The country's going to miss him. His family's going to miss him. His crew's going to miss him.
And you're going to miss him.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is no hero. They're just a group of four people who did their job, and it was an unusual circumstance, but we put our best resources and knowledge together and did what we thought was best.
That's Woodbury County Emergency Services Director Gary Brown and a friend of Captain Al Haynes. Haynes would have been 88 years old this Saturday. Aviation experts have called the incident on July 19, 1989, a quote, one in a million landing. According to a pilot from United Airlines, until then, flight simulations all ended with the plane plummeting from the sky. And that's it for this edition of The Exchange. We're going to leave you with a performance by Angie Lambrecht, recorded here at Siouxland Public Media. You can see her live at Art Splash on the main stage Saturday at 3, and Art Splash runs Saturday and Sunday at Riverside Park in Sioux City. Thanks for listening. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.
Got me a real nice honeybee now, you know he treats me good. He lets me do my part as a lady like any real man should. Cause I like to hustle and to bustle around the neighborhood. Pass on my loving to my homies like any good woman should. And when I come crawling home, you know he opens up the door. He wraps me in his arms, cause he knows I got a pocket full of mojo, and I got an ace in the hole. And with the voice of an angel, yeah baby I could make any man fall. I got a pocket full of mojo, and I'm riling on some bag of bones. Could have you down on your knees, honey, making you scream and moan, yeah. I catch my honey sticking a peek here every once in a while. Now watch his eyes light up bright like the 4th of July. Now watch him wiggle and giggle just like a wired child. He makes my heart go in a flutter, you know that he drives me wild. And when I come crawling home, you know he opens up the door. He wraps me in his arms, cause he knows I got a pocket full of mojo, and I got an ace in the hole. And with the voice of an angel, well baby I can make any man fall. Got a pocket full of mojo, and I'm riling on some bag of bones. Could have you down on your knees, honey, making you scream and moan.